This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
I got down on the floor when no one was at home, crying uncontrollably and screaming out to Almighty God to help me through this situation and to help my family and my daughters.
Kentucky House Speaker Jeff Hoover officially steps down from his leadership post after acknowledging that he secretly settled a sexual harassment claim. Also, who's going to replace Josh Mandel now that he's dropped out of the U.S. Senate race? Senator Rob Portman says there's lots of interest.
I would assume there are going to be a lot of people who jumped in. I'm thinking how many people have called me in the last few days. I think it's five different people said they might be interested. They've either texted me or called me. And so I think it'll be a spirited primary.
It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area, and we'll start with the news from Kentucky with political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher. Good afternoon, Daniel.
Hey, good afternoon.
And Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief, Rylan Barton. Rylan, good afternoon.
Hi there. How's it going?
Great, thank you. We're not going to be able to take any calls during this part of the show, but you can still email your questions to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Daniel, Jeff Hoover makes it official this week. He steps down as the Kentucky House Speaker. How do you describe, how do you characterize the speech that he gave when he was resigning?
It was certainly interesting. I mean, in many ways, it was unprecedented. It's pretty uncommon for, I guess, a speaker to resign in the first place, but then to make a speech of that magnitude, it was around 20 minutes long. He went through a whole slew of things. He talked about how he went into a depression after the story came out and how he lost 33 pounds in 4 weeks. He accused a former staffer of orchestrating the whole plot against him. He criticized another staffer who was standing on the House floor. And, of course, he said that the governor of his own party was spreading lies about him from, quote, the deepest pits of hell. So it was a rather unusual thing. I think a lot of representatives were kind of taken aback and were a little bit wowed by it. It was a powerful way, I guess, for him to resign his speakership.
Ryland, the Associated Press described it as a fiery speech. What's your take on what you heard?
Sure, fiery, blistering. It was pretty out of this world, especially to just kind of see so much, you know, political infighting, you know, and intra-political infighting. This is kind of, you know, there's a bit of a Republican civil war going on in Frankfort right now. To see the Republican Speaker of the House, who's just installed there last year, the first Republican to lead the chamber in nearly a century, to be going after, only the second governor, second Republican governor in a half of a century, was quite unusual. These are people, two men who were really on the same political team for the last couple of years since the governor's been in office, and it's been pretty wild here. It's been certainly seeping into kind of how these legislators try to address other issues. You know, the big thing on the plate of lawmakers here right now is a pension overhaul and also a state budget they have to write, which is likely going to have lots of cuts. And this has just kind of delayed that whole process. And given the whole lot of, there's just a whole lot of bad feelings among Republicans in the House right now.
Who takes over as House Speaker now?
It's House Speaker Pro Tem David Osborne. So he's the number two man in the House, or at least the guy who's elected to fill in for the House Speaker if the House Speaker isn't around. And so there is a bit of controversy around this. I think for some people they wanted to. Or at least Democrats were calling for there to be an election for a new House Speaker. Certainly Republicans don't want that to happen. And also it seems like the legal consensus at the moment is that they don't need to, that they can continue to operate with Speaker Pro Tem David Osborne. He's from the suburbs of Louisville to lead the chamber for the rest of the year. And, you know, then there will be a new set of leadership elections during the next legislative session next year.
Daniel, did you want to add anything to that?
No, he covered it. I just didn't know who was taking the question.
Oh, okay. My apologies there. So Daniel, how much has Hoover admitted to? I mean, what is he acknowledged doing?
So he has acknowledged secretly settling a sexual harassment allegation made against him by a legislative staffer, but he has said that there was no sexual harassment, and he had never admitted to sexual harassment. He has admitted to sending inappropriate text messages to the staffer, but he says that the text messages were consensual and that beyond that he didn't really do anything. There's a whistleblower lawsuit that has been filed against House GOP caucus. And in that whistleblower lawsuit, the person who filed, Daisy Olivo, who is the communications director, she said that there had been some sort of sexual contact between Hoover and the staffer who charged him with sexual harassment. But he denies that. He says that there was no sexual misconduct.
How many other Kentucky lawmakers have been accused of sexual harassment? There are several others, aren't there?
Yeah, so there's three more in this same sexual harassment settlement. Three Republican lawmakers, Representative Brian Linder, Representative Michael Meredith, and Representative Jim DeCesare. There's also the House GOP caucus chief of staff, Ginger Wills, is named in the sexual harassment settlement for creating a toxic work environment, not for sexual harassment. At the same time, in the Senate, Senator Julian Carroll, who used to be a governor, he was accused of groping a then 30-year-old man back in 2005. His alleged victim was actually greeted on the Senate floor yesterday in a kind of weird turn of events. And then there was, of course, Representative Dan Johnson, who was accused of molesting a 17-year-old girl, and he killed himself just before Christmas.
Ryland, Hoover has proposing a new rule that would have penalized lawmakers when they accused other lawmakers in a complaint that doesn't eventually result in expulsion. What came of that? Did that make it through? Did that get knocked off?
Sure. Long story short, it got knocked off. This has been another part of the drama. When the House came into session last week, they passed this new disciplinary rule that would create a special investigative committee if two lawmakers filed a complaint against another. So the very next day after this rule was approved, eight Republican lawmakers filed a complaint against former Speaker Hoover, and alleging having to do with all these sexual harassment allegations. That committee actually met twice, I believe, before Hoover then took to the House floor and delivered another fiery speech proposing his own rule that would require lawmakers to pay for legal fees if they file a complaint against another lawmaker and that complaint fails, if it ultimately doesn't result in another lawmaker being expelled. So a little complicated. But it certainly threw everybody in the House into a tizzy for a day, and the rule. So some people wanted it to pass, and some people wanted it to fail. They let it sit for a day, and then the next day they ended up pulling that original rule that created the whole investigative committee process. So there's no legislative committee looking into former Speaker Hoover allegations anymore. It's all up to the Legislative Ethics Commission now, which is an independent agency that's been looking into it for the past month or so.
And just to be clear, Hoover he's not giving up his House seat. He's just giving up the leadership position. Is that right, Daniel?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, that is right. He, even though the governor has called on him to resign, and there are eight Republican members of the House of Representatives who have called on him to resign from office completely.
And as Ryland was saying, no other investigations other than the Ethics Committee that's investigating right now, or the Ethics, what's the name of the organization, Ryland, sorry?
The Legislative Ethics Commission. Although also the FBI, supposedly, they confirmed last month at least that they were looking into the allegations and whether there was anything they needed to look into about the allegations of retaliation as well. So it's unclear where that stands right now. But that, if you want to count that also as an investigation.
And the other three lawmakers that were accused in this, are there any ongoing investigations with them?
They've kind of been forgotten about.
Go ahead, Daniel. Sorry.
They haven't been forgotten about completely, but all the attention's been on Hoover lately. And so they were all removed from their positions of leadership on committees. But other than that, it's been kind of quiet. Nobody's been actively calling for their resignation. I mean, the governor has said that anybody who secretly settled a sexual harassment complaint should resign from office. He's never called out people by name. He's just been saying anybody who secretly settled a sexual harassment allegation. So in that regard, yes, they've been called on to resign from office as well, but nobody's been kind of singling them out. When the Democrats are making floor speeches each day to kind of try and keep this in the public's consciousness, they've been mostly talking about Hoover and talking about the speakership and whether or not there were problems there.
Any idea if there are...
And all three, none of those three lawmakers have filed for re-election yet. There's a January 30th deadline. Jim DeCesare, he's a Republican lawmaker from Bowling Green, and he's one of those lawmakers implicated in the scandal. He's announced he's not running for re-election.
Riley, you also write that there are 9 Democrats in the Kentucky House who are not going to be running for re-election. Why aren't they going to be running?
Well, I think that you might look at it and you say, well, it's not a lot of fun being in the minority. And some of these lawmakers, they're long-term incumbent Democrats, and so yeah, you can say not as fun, much fun being in the minority these days. They don't really have a voice on besides kind of voicing opposition to some of these some kind of big Republican initiatives that have been passed over the last year. But I mean, some of them are very close to. I mean, they're kind of in that retirement age. Former House Speaker Jody Richards, he's from Bowling Green. He's 80 years old. He's been in the House since 1976. He's the longest-serving House Speaker. And then there's a couple Democratic lawmakers from the class of 1991 when they first arrived from Louisville. And so I think there's this variety. I think that some of them are concerned about re-election and they're just deciding to run for local office. There's a couple of them that are running for judge executive. James Kay, a Democrat from Versailles, he's running for Woodford County judge executive. And Will Corsi from Simpsonia way out in western Kentucky is running for Marshall County judge executive. So, yeah, they're kind of moving on to greener pastures. And Democrats are just very severely in the minority in the Kentucky House right now. They have 36 out of the 100 seats. So it's not looking like they can mount a campaign to totally retake the House this year, although Democrats certainly say that they're going to try and capitalize on the scandal that Republicans are going through in the House right now, and also some of the unpopularity of President Trump. Although certainly in some of these districts in rural Kentucky, the president is still very popular.
So we're at 9 Democrats so far. Might the number keep growing, Ryland?
It could keep growing. I mean, the thing is that there aren't too many more to pick off. I mean, 9 Democrats is 25% of the entire Democratic caucus, but there's rumblings that there could be more, but nothing yet.
We will continue our review of the news. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guests are political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher, and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief, Ryland Barton. We won't be able to take your calls during this part of the show, but you can still email your questions to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Ryland, meantime, while all this is going on with Jeff Hoover, you've got work on Kentucky's pension system that still has to be done. There had been some talk that this would be passed in the first 2 weeks of the legislative session. Where do things stand? What kind of progress has been made at this point?
Any progress that's been made has been behind closed doors. We've been asking about the update of a pension overhaul every day, and they say the Republican leaders of the legislature say they've been waiting for numbers to come back from some of the pension systems before they release kind of their next draft of the pension bill. But I think it's without a doubt that the sexual harassment scandal kind of slowed things down. But we have hints at what a new pension bill might look like. That original pension bill would have basically phased out the state's use of a defined benefit pension system. That's one that guarantees benefits to people for life, and basically be shifting future employees and even some current employees to 401k retirement plan. So that part of it is probably going to stay intact, although sounds like some of the parts that would affect current employees would be phased out, and then some other parts that affect current employees, a suspension of cost of living adjustments for teachers for 5 years, retired teachers for 5 years. That might be scaled back. There's another like 3% surcharge on employees' salaries that would go to towards retiree health. And that might be scaled back. So it sounds like we're going to have a slightly watered down version of the pension bill that comes out. Who knows? Maybe the next week or so.
Yeah, that kind of makes me. We call it. These sound like proposals at this point. Is there an actual bill that's being suggested yet?
Nope. or at least we.
You got it.
You haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's talk that there's different versions that are being written in the Senate and the House, and they're sending them out for actuarial analysis and information. But we haven't seen one yet. We've been told any day now for a while. Speaker Pro Tem David Osborne said that he expected it to drop this week. The snow may have gotten in his way, but there was no bill this week. So they've written something. They've scaled something back, but there's been nothing for the public to see so far.
Mm-hmm. Any idea when something is coming down the path?
Ryland?
I
know you guys are just the messengers.
We've been told before Christmas. We've been told next week. We've been told later this week. And yeah, so at this point, it's just anybody's guess.
Yeah. Ryland, you have an event with Governor Bevin you need to go cover, so we'll let you go at this point. We appreciate you being on. That was Ryland Barton, Kentucky Capitol Bureau Chief. And we have Daniel DeRocher still on the line with us. Daniel, how bad a shape is Kentucky's pension in? I mean, what prompted this whole, we've got to do something, we've got to overhaul the system?
It's in really bad shape. I mean, we've got one of the largest unfunded liabilities of any state in the country. It's billions of dollars. And Governor Bevin's been repeating it. It's got to be addressed. It's got to be addressed. And they're going to be putting more money toward it. I think they've called for an extra $700 million that need to be put toward the pension system this budget cycle. And so it's going to be a lot more. And in that regard, if you're putting more money toward the pension system, they're saying that there needs to be some reform. It needs to change so that we're not having to keep putting this much money in, so that it's not growing to be such a large part of the budget. I think right now the estimates are that it's around 20% of the budget. And so they want to see some reform. Now Democrats push back and they say, well, the reform that they're proposing may cost more in the short term, and we won't really see the benefits of the reform for another 30 years. And they push back on some of those issues. But I think regardless, no matter what, the state is in this position where they need to pay down this unfunded liability, and they need to do something to address the pension system. And so no matter the solution, whether that's raising revenue, as the Democrats have often touted, or whether it's trying to scale back and putting in these these freezes on the cost of living adjustment would save some money in the pension system, whether it's solutions like that, something has to be done. Something has to be addressed.
Yeah, what is it? Kentucky's pension system is what, the second? I think it's second worst in the country?
It depends. I mean, Illinois's got a really bad one. New Jersey's got a really bad one. I think we're a little bit less than Illinois, but I think those numbers move back and forth. So it's either the worst, the second worst. Governor Bevin loves to say that we have the worst funded pension system in the country.
Now, the General Assembly also has to craft a 2-year state budget. And I imagine the whole pension issue is making this even more complicated. How are things shaping up with the budget at this point?
We're going to get the governor's budget address on Tuesday, and that's when he's going to put forward what he thinks the budget should look like. The legislature can either follow his guidelines or they could just throw it in the trash and do their own thing. Likely they'll follow his guidelines. We're in for a pretty, I forget the exact word that the governor used, but it's going to be a draconian budget. There's going to be a lot of cuts, a lot of slashing, and I think we're going to see it across the board. I know the governor has said that the SEEK funding formula won't be changed, but you really never know because lawmakers are saying that that might be in question. So there may be cuts to education. There may be cuts. I think there will pretty much just be cuts across the board. And again, this is in large part because of the way that the governor wants to address the pension system, because we do have this billion. It's billions. It's, I think, in the $40 billion of unfunded liability. He's saying that we need to be putting more money toward the pension system right now so that we can start getting our credit rating back up and we can start so that that hole becomes a little bit less. And so when you're allocating all the I think it's $1 billion or around there to pensions, you're going to have to make cuts elsewhere. It's just that's the way with the way that revenue is coming in, where there's going to have to be cuts.
And there have been talk about changing Kentucky's tax code. I mean, what happens with that whole idea?
Yes, the governor has said that he wants to reform the tax code. Taxes is really hard. No lawmaker really wants to be on the record for saying that they raised taxes. And so it seems there have been different proposals, right? A lot of Democrats have said, well, what about legalizing recreational marijuana, or what about legalizing casino gambling? The governor has kind of shot down those ideas, saying, well, that's not going to be enough to cover this thing, and it won't make any difference. He sees an opportunity to try and get rid of tax loopholes, and that's his big push, is that he needs to reform the tax loopholes. That's also really difficult because all of those loopholes is in there for a reason, and all of those loopholes have somebody behind them saying, well, you can't cut this because you'll hurt my industry. And so cutting taxes or raising revenue is such a big struggle that it seems like it's not really heading anywhere. They haven't really had too many discussions or too many solid discussions on tax reform. It's been mostly focused on, well, how do we revise the pension system?
Daniel, you mentioned legalizing marijuana. I understand there's a bill making its way through the General Assembly to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would legalize medical marijuana in Kentucky.
Yeah, so there's a couple bills to legalize medical marijuana. I know Julian Carroll has one. Dan Syme has one. There's one in the House of Representatives. Usually, as sad as it is, usually you have to look at the letter behind the name of the person who's sponsoring the bill, because Republican bills tend to get heard when Republicans are in power, and Democratic bills tend to get heard when Democrats are in power. And so there's one Republican bill, Dan Syme proposed it. I don't know whether or not we're going to see it. I know the governor says that he supports medicinal marijuana if it's done correctly, but he does not support recreational marijuana. I don't see much movement happening with any of these bills, but I mean, prediction is the lowest form of journalism, and we'll have to see if they get anywhere.
Well, like you say, you don't see this going anywhere. How many times has this issue come up in Kentucky's General Assembly?
It's come up a lot. I mean, the topic is it's a hot topic, right? 29 states, I think. I don't know if that number is exactly right, but a lot of states have legalized medicinal marijuana. And there's actually a lot of popular support for legalizing medicinal marijuana. It's just, I mean, if you look at the way Kentucky's liquor laws even are written, you know, we still have some dry counties. So it's a struggle to try and get everybody on board with the idea of, well, hey, maybe medicinal marijuana can help people. Although our neighbor to the east, West Virginia, did legalize medicinal marijuana last year. So there's movement in the region. Maybe it could happen. But I don't know if this is the year that it will happen.
And I think I stated that incorrectly, too. I said it was a constitutional amendment for the medical marijuana bill, but that's not the case. It's just a straight bill.
Yeah, there's a couple of them out there, so I was afraid to directly engage on any of them. It's usually I think the ones that the one that has the best chance of passing, I guess, would be Dan Syme's, and that one would require I think it would be legalized through legislation.
Yeah, but there is a constitutional amendment about changing the way that Kentucky voters pick their governor, or at least the time when they pick their governor.
Yes, that one, I'm actually writing about it right now. That one, it would move it so that that you would elect the governor in the same year that you elect presidential candidates. And so the voters would get to decide whether or not they wanted to have two elections every 4 years instead of three elections every 4 years. Republicans are in support of this bill. It would save money for the state government, and it would save money for the local government. They're also in support of this in part because of down-ballot voting, right? that Kentucky's been leaning Republican of late, and if people are voting for a Republican presidential candidate, they're more likely to vote for a Republican gubernatorial candidate, and it helps them keep control. Democrats push back against it for that very reason. They also say that it would give fewer. The way it was phrased to me would be, would you rather have your state represented by different parties, you know, at the state level versus the national level, or would you like it for it to all be uniform and represented by the same party all the way through? And that's really what this vote comes down to.
So if the GA passes this still has to go to the voters because it's a constitutional amendment.
Yes, it would be up to the voters to pass it. And the way that it's phrased on the ballot is, would you like to save money by switching elections every 2 years instead of every 4 years, or at least that's how the House bill phrased it.
And then if this passes, it would take effect what year?
It would take effect in 2024. So say if Governor Bevin runs for a second term and wins re-election, he would serve a five-year term in his second term. So he would get to stay on for a full 9 years.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRosier. Coming up, it's been a week of political shakeups in several Ohio races. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us now, Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow. Good afternoon, Andy.
Hi, good afternoon to you.
And Cincinnati Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams. Hi, Jason. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
You can join us, 513-419-7100 with your questions, or you can email us talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Andy, let's start with Josh Mandel leaving the Senate race against incumbent Sherrod Brown. Now, this has to do with his wife's health. Is that's why he's stepping down?
Yeah, Josh put out an email this time last week saying that his wife was going through an undisclosed health issue and that he decided that campaigning would take too much time away from his wife, too much time away from his kids and his family. So he decided to drop out of the race, which was a big shocker, a big surprise to all of us here. I think if you were to ask anybody about all the contenders running for all the different races, you would have said that Josh Mandel was the stalwart, the guy who was going to stick around the longest. So
top candidate. Right,
and that caused a big shuffle for all sorts of other places. So it kind of started a domino effect.
Now, you mentioned in the statement, you said it was undisclosed what his wife is going through. Nobody knows at this point what she's suffering or what she has to face here.
Right, no one knows the nature of what she's going through right now, and I doubt that that's ever going to be disclosed. But it was something that was important enough to him to drop out of the race and focus on his family.
Yeah, Jason, how big a lurch does this leave the GOP in Ohio in?
Well, it leaves them in a lurch. They just replace Mandel with Jim Renacci, who had been running for governor. So he goes from being a big underdog in the gubernatorial primary to probably being the favorite in the Senate primary, but also being I see him as a big underdog in the Senate race. Brown's people are concerned because they had the playbook on Mandel. They beat him in 2012. There's a lot of things that Mandel has stepped in over the years, and so they felt really good about that. Now there's a little fear of the unknown, a fear of how's a clean slate GOP candidate going to fare. Renacci received Trump's blessing this week, and then made it official yesterday to be in the Senate race. My take on this is I don't see anybody short of John Kasich really having a legitimate shot at beating Sherrod Brown.
But what is Kasich? Does he have any interest? Do we know?
He does not. As far as we know, he himself, or really his campaign or political people, one of his political consultants put out a tweet saying he doesn't have interest, but he himself has not said anything, and there's been no official statement, and it's been really hard to get him on this. But what it sounds like behind the scenes is that this is they're not even, this isn't even being considered. And now Kasich's been asked before, and he was asked last year, even when Mandel was, you know, the whole, when they were trying to find someone to run against Brown, and Kasich had no interest. He's focused completely on 2020 running against Trump for president. And he feels like after his governorship is up here at the end of the year that he can, you know, do exactly what he wants to do, and that's continue to go on all the, you know, the talk show circuit and speak across the country, raise money, and he doesn't feel like he needs to go to the Senate to bolster his campaign in 2020.
Yeah, the governor's always been somebody to have a long-term plan. He always knows what he's going to what he wants to accomplish in the 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road, and what he needs to do to get there. And I think that running for Senate is definitely against what that plan would be. I mean, if like what Jason just said, if he wants to be president, if he wants to go up against Donald Trump, then running for Senate kind of takes him out of that national rhetoric talk and puts him into a statewide Senate race where it's not a given. It would be a very tough battle between him and Sherrod Brown, and it takes him off his own message, which is more of bringing people together in a more bipartisan approach. So pitting him up against a strong Democrat would go against that message.
If 2020 is his end goal, which it seems like it is, it's really too risky to run for Senate. I mean, yeah, sure, you can go there, and if you win, that's a nice win. You can go there and vote against Trump's policies. Okay, great. But really, what does he gain? And then he has to turn around in 13 months and say, oh, hey, donors, thanks for voting me into the, or getting me into the Senate, and now I'm going to turn around and run for president 12, 13 months later. It's you know, what's there's just seems to be a little too risky for him and not much of an upside there, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So Jim Renacci is sliding over into this spot, leaving the governor's race, sliding over into the U.S. Senate race. Anybody else, any other names popping up?
Mike Gibbons, Cleveland businessman. And it's interesting because when Mandel made his decision last week, you know, there was all this speculation from the Trump folks and from the, you know, Republican establishment about who could it be, Renacci, you know, some people threw Kasich out there. You know, there are a lot of names, Butler County Sheriff Richard Jones, J.D. Vance, hillbilly elegy author. But nobody mentioned Mike Gibbons, who's been in the race for several months now. So that kind of says what people think about him, I think, or at least, you know, the internal folks. Mitch McConnell has been talking to J.D. Vance, the author who's from the greater Cincinnati area, Middletown. I'm telling you, though, like, you know, for all of the issues that Mandel has politically, he still has he's an incredible fundraiser, and he still has an incredible statewide name ID. Incredible maybe is too strong of a word, but. And really, the Republicans, I mean, Renacci does not have that. Renacci does not have statewide name ID. And in a race like this, you really got to have it. You know, we'll see if Trump jumps in here. I'm sure he will and stump for him. I don't know how much that'll move the needle.
And as we've been saying about all these races for 2018, it's hard to tell how much President Trump would play a role and not just the Trump effect in general. So will the people who came out and voted for Trump in 2016 also come out again for somebody like Renacci? Would, if Renacci tries to reflect or sort of echo the same talking points that Trump said in 2016, would that be more or less effective now? And I think it's hard to tell, but I would say that shine is starting to wear off, and people are not going to have as much success as Trump did trying to go with that game plan.
Any talk of Mary Taylor sliding over into the Senate race?
Andy, I know there was some, you know, there was a little bit of buzz, she said no, but I think Andy would probably, you know, being in Columbus there would probably
might have heard more about it.
Yeah.
I would say that Mary Taylor's in for the governor's race at this point, and I don't see her changing that anytime soon. Either way, she has not raised a lot of money. She's struggling in fundraising. So whether it's in the race that she's currently in, running for governor, or switching over to the Senate side, she would be a big underdog when it comes to raising funds. And now that Renacci has already staked his claim in that area and also got the president's blessing on it, I think it would be a hard sell to have Mary Taylor move at this point. Also, when you think of the dynamics of the race now, she is one of only two female candidates running for governor. So that brings that element to it, too. So I think she'll stay in the governor's race.
And go ahead.
Oh, just to add finish to that, I mean, I think probably she further stated her no on the Senate race this week by naming a lieutenant governor candidate, a mm-hmm. former Procter & Gamble exec here in Cincinnati, Nathan S. Truth, who I've heard great things about, a very strong conservative and what she wanted and what you would want, I guess, as a Republican candidate in the primary. But the thing is like, I don't know if it moves the needle because she really needed to make a big splash. As Andy said, her fundraising has lagged. And, you know, she's going up against a juggernaut in Mike DeWine, John Husted.
So she's picking up what? Is this kind of the, I've got an outsider's position I'm taking here? Okay.
Yes, very much. So that's her approach here. Fresh face, you know, maybe she can try to, you know, gain some momentum. I think what she's thinking is she can maybe gain some momentum that this person has never been in politics, kind of like Trump, but I don't know, he's not like Trump in personality-wise. So I'm not comparing him in that way, but just more so like as a complete outsider business person, longtime business leader in Cincinnati for Procter & Gamble.
Was S. Truth a little surprised to be picked for this role, do you think?
I don't know. Actually, I haven't talked to him. I don't know if Andy, if you got a chance to talk to him. Or...
No, not yet. But I mean, I will say I think he's well known in conservative circles and right to life circles as well.
Yeah.
So I think not only does he have name recognition in the places where you would want name recognition, but I think he can also tap into wealthy donors who can maybe shell out some money for the Taylor campaign.
And several years ago, he's and this was told to me by some political insiders here in Cincinnati that, you know, he's a Ken Blackwell protege, and he did some campaign work for Blackwell several years ago. I believe it was on one of his run for Congress in early 90s. So he kind of comes out of that, you know, strong social conservative mold of Ken Blackwell.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join us, let's talk to Nathan. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
I'm calling actually just to kind of raise the issue that we have three parties in this race, and not just the Republicans and Democrats running, but the Ohio has a minor political party. The Green Party has a candidate running for governor, Constance Goodell Newton, running on a platform with legalization of marijuana, free college from preschool, free education from preschool to college, as well as health care for all. Routinely, I don't really hear any conversations at all about the fact that there's another candidate in the race, and I just wanted to bring that up.
And who is the Green candidate? I'm sorry, on the phone line, it was a little difficult to hear.
Constance Goodell Newton.
Okay, Constance Goodell Newton. Any comments?
No, thanks for letting us know, Nathan. I guess my thought is I wasn't aware of this, so thanks for giving the heads up, and, there's, you know, just so much talk in the Republican, you know, the whole Trump versus everyone thing. And I think it's interesting that, you know, this is a political environment where, you know, more of a third party or outsider types, you know, feel like there's a shot here to make inroads. And I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump completely on two different sides of the coin really opened that up for candidates and, you know, really turned the topsy-turvy, the political world upside down 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to note just what avenues people are taking to seek office, because a lot of the platforms that Nathan just mentioned – including legalization of marijuana. That's something that Bill O'Neill, who's a Democratic candidate, is touting as well. And I think Bill O'Neill would usually fit more of a Green Party mode, mold. Mm-hmm. But I think he's been a Democrat, so he's going the Democratic route. And so I think we're seeing a lot of progressive candidates just jump into the Democratic side and seek office that way. So, for example, if we were to talk about somebody like Nina Turner, she a former state senator, she ran for Secretary of State. If she were to jump in as anybody's running mate, I'm not saying that's happening, but just someone like her who did endorse the Green Party nominee for president, Jill Stein, in the past. But I still think someone like her would go with the Democratic Party rather than with the Green Party. So it's just a comment on the dynamics that's working out here in the race.
Yeah, because there's two really, I mean, there's two pretty hard, you know, I define primaries here. And certainly the Democratic side is still a little bit crowded. It's dwindled this week with Nan Whaley leaving today and Betty Sutton dropping out to be Cordray's running mate. But, you know, there's been so much talk around really, I mean, recently and just in the last few weeks, I think around the Democratic primary particularly, that, you know, there's just that's where the focus has been so far. And, you know, you're still coming up on May here. So, you know, a little less than five months away on the primary.
Why is Nan Whaley dropping out? What's going on with her campaign?
It's just she's an establishment candidate who is the Dayton mayor who lacks statewide name ID. And when, you know, she saw the writing on the wall, you know, Cordray in that race, it's his to lose. And he has tremendous, you know, statewide name ID. He's the only one in that race. Well, now Dennis Kucinich is getting in. But otherwise, maybe Bill O'Neill a little bit. But Cordray has the strongest statewide name ID. And then he turns around and picks Betty Sutton, who there was a lot of insiders who thought, you know, probably before Cordray got in, she was, you know, maybe if you're going to say there's a front runner of the four that were previously in, she was going to be it. More so because she's really battle tested, a former congresswoman from Northeast Ohio, has been in some real intense battles, can raise money, has obviously been to Washington, and so has fundraising connections there. Also, you know, she has a nice story, created the Cash for Clunkers, was right on the program, which, you know, we all know was in the headlines around the recession. And so when you turn around and you have, you know, Cordray and Sutton team up, the writing's on the wall, and Whaley certainly has a very bright future, I believe, in politics. She's very well liked in the party, and I think they see big things for her and that she's part of the bench.
Yeah, and I think that throughout this process, Whaley has really been able to build her own brand and build her name recognition and shake a lot of hands, meet a lot of people. I would say if I were to read the tea leaves a little bit here, I would say that I think she maybe got a couple of calls from people within the party, maybe asking her to step down and mm-hmm. to make way for Cordray and Sutton. If you were to read some of the tweets from Connie Pillich, who's still in the race as a Democratic candidate, Pillich wrote a couple of tweets yesterday, sort of referring to the fact that she's been getting calls from big people in the party, trying to lean on her to step down. And so, but she's saying at this point, she was saying that she's not, and she thinks it's really important for her, not only for her to run, but for her to remain in the race, because this means that there's only one woman running for the Democratic ticket. There were three, and now there's only one.
Andy, does the combination of Sutton with Cordray, is that the Democrat equivalent of the power ticket on the GOP side, DeWine and Husted?
Well, if you're asking if it matches the strength pound for pound with DeWine and Husted, I don't think it does as much. I think that if you asked Democrats and more Democrats who follow state politics regularly, I think they would say it is. But I think for the average Ohioan, I doubt that they know who Cordray and Sutton is as much as they might know who DeWine and Husted are. So I think they have a lot of time and they have a lot of work ahead of them to build their own name recognition and get their word out there. But I think that there's a lot of people who think that Cordray and Sutton are a powerful team. But again, if you ask average Ohioans, I don't think that they know them as much as Democrats would think they do.
Yeah, I fully, wholeheartedly agree with that. You know, from the Democratic insider type of thing, it's, you know, they see this as their DeWine-Husted alliance. And certainly from what they have who in the governor's race, that was probably the strongest alliance they could have formed. But yes, certainly it is not on the name ID level and fundraising prowess level as a DeWine-Husted.
Now,
and the other thing is they could get tagged as DC insiders. Cordray's been out of the state for a really long time now. When Sutton did serve, she served in Congress, so she was in DC. Meanwhile, you have DeWine, who's been here for the past 7 years, and then Husted, who's been serving for Secretary of State. So it's easy for the Republicans to build this messaging as we're from Ohio, we're Ohioans building Ohio. They could tag Cordray and Sutton as DC insiders, Ohio outsiders.
So you got DC insiders versus Columbus insiders, huh?
Yeah.
Andy, I wanted to ask you too. Bill O'Neill named his running mate this week. Tell us, it's Chantel Lewis.
Yeah, Chantel Lewis. I believe that she's a school principal in the Lorain area. It seems like what he's doing is trying to also go for that running mate who represents something of an outsider. And I think it's interesting that he chose a school principal. So it seems like he wants to make sure everybody knows that he wants to focus on education and reforming the education system here and probably funding as well. So he went with a school administrator. And I believe she also served on city council for the East Cleveland area. But definitely, if you were to talk about people who were chosen as outsiders, like we were saying about Nathan S. Truth, I believe Chantel Lewis is that kind of candidate on the Democratic side.
And Jason, you wrote this week that Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Purival might be taking on Congressman Steve Chabot. Has there been any official confirmation of that yet? Or
there's official confirmation that he has been recruited and that he is interested in. You know, he is exploring it. I believe this is a serious thing, and I've had folks tell me like they really think he's going to do it. Now the DCCC has been quietly recruiting him for several months. They've really tried to get a big name local candidate. They've talked to Todd Portune, they've talked to PG Sittenfeld, they've talked to Alicia Reese, they've talked to Aftab Purival. I know the Chabot folks are they're prepared for a dogfight if Aftab jumps in, and he's a dynamic campaigner. We still don't know really a lot about him. He just burst on the scene in 2016, beat a big-name West Side, an incumbent. But it's a different story between running for Congress and running for Clerk of Courts.
Yeah, and before—
You know, I could—
Go ahead, Andy.
If I could just mention, you know, I went to Cincinnati for an event because that was during Labor Day where everybody thought maybe Rich Cordray would jump into the race. And that was the first time I had ever saw Aftab do anything before or even heard his name. And I walked away from that thinking that he was the most impressive speaker of everybody lined up, and that includes Cordray.
He'd have to get through the Democratic primary first, though. He'd have some competition there, wouldn't he?
So far, it looks like that Rabbi Robert Barr is now, and he's a first-time candidate. He's really surprised a lot of people. He announced this week that he's raised over $230,000, which is, for someone that no one really knows, is a very solid number. And, you know, he's running a very serious campaign. Tough, tough, tough race to beat Chabot in a— You know, the lines are drawn in a very red-leaning type of way. And Chabot is seeking his 12th term. And there have been many, many Democrats since he first got in the early 90s who have tried it. Big-name Democrats locally, John Cranley, Roxanne Qualls, and only Steve Driehaus for one term has been able to beat Steve Chabot.
Andy and Jason, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow, and Cincinnati Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams.